weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to Bennett DeSilva for driving us home this afternoon. It's Friday, the 23rd of August, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Alan Cawley, Fergal Brennan and Peter Smith will set us up for another weekend of Premier League action, and we'll also look back on last night's European football and tonight's League of Ireland. Maeve De Burka will also join us to preview the quarterfinal of the Sports Direct Women's FAI Cup. Shane Stokes will reflect on today's Volta action, and Jane Mangan has the racing news of the day and will also preview the weekend as well. If you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552 or on WhatsApp 087 187 9200.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome along, Alan Cawley with me in the studio. Good to see you, Al.
Marie, welcome back. It's good to see you too. How are you?
Good, I had a great holiday. Glad to be back now. Just trying to remember all my passwords and getting back into things. Takes a while.
Come 37 minutes past six, it'll feel like you were never away.
I know, yeah. Well, it nearly feels like that already and it's 4 minutes past six. Al, before we get into last night's European action, a bit of breaking news. Mm. So a lot of talk about Sunday's game between Dundalk and St. Pat's. St. Patrick's Athletic looking to have it postponed because of their situation in Europe. Lots of strong words from Stephen Kenny, the Pats manager, over the last few days. And now it has been confirmed that the rescheduled fixture between Dundalk and St. Pat's has been postponed. So the League of Ireland have put out a statement and that game is not going to go ahead. Right, Col?
They've buckled. Under the intense pressure and heat from Stephen Kenny, they've buckled. But no, to be fair, Marie, is it the right call? When you think of the opportunity and after the result at St. Pat's got last night, where they played really, really well. For anyone that doesn't know, they drew nil all, giving themselves a chance in the second leg, albeit away to Turkish opposition that are very good, but Bakakashir. And it's going to be a difficult task, but they've kept the tie very much alive. They played very well last night and they're in with a chance of potentially reaching a group stage. So I'd be a hypocrite now if I said it was the wrong call. And I tell you why, Marie. For years and years, we've been shouting about the greater good of football and doing the right thing rather than self-interest from a lot of corners and a lot of places. And Stephen Kenny genuinely said this during the week as well, that how good would it be for two teams to get potentially get into a group stage in terms of the eyes on it and I suppose the interest that would come from two teams being in a group stage and potentially trying to grow the game here like we're always trying to do and we're always trying to fight our corner. I think for that reason and the chance that they have next week and asking them to play a game on Sunday and it would only leave them 3 days recovery time to go back out to play again on Wednesday against the team from Turkey, it would have been asking too much of them to try and get them through a group stage if they were faced with that league game on Sunday. So for that reason, I think it's the right call. From Dundalk's point of view, they'll be very disappointed about it because obviously they're fighting for themselves in the Premier Division and trying to stay up. I think this will mean a couple of weeks break for them now with no game. So they would have wanted the game to go ahead. So they'll be disappointed about it. But it's very difficult to please everyone, Marie. But I think if you boil it down and for the greater good of the game in this country and to potentially have two teams qualified, we already have Shamrock Rovers qualified for the group stage, to potentially have another one like St. Patrick's Athletic and Stephen Kenny, I'm happy with the call and I can live with it.
Okay, well, you're kind of echoing what the statement that was put out by the League of Ireland. They said that the decision was taken as a result of the unique opportunity that now exists for two League of Ireland clubs to compete in the league phase of the UEFA club competitions for the first time. They've taken into consideration the exceptional circumstances that the fixture between each leg for St. Pat's is 6 days instead of the standard seven, and the League of Ireland has postponed Sunday's fixture. There'll be a new date announced in due course. So look, it's fair enough. Stephen Kenny has been quite vocal on it, and to be fair, I think a lot of people were listening to him, and the performance of his team last night I think did a huge amount as well to help them along the way because they were so good. Al
played really, really well, Marie. And even before we get to the game, obviously people from Dundalk will be disappointed, but people will also know from Dundalk that when they qualified for the group stage, and Stephen was the manager at the time, and he's already faced this kind of stuff, and they had to play 3 games a week going for a league title. They eventually won the league title, which was an unbelievable achievement because of the challenges that they were being faced, having to play those 3 games a week in a lot of cases because of the group stage. They had to play a game in Russia. I remember when they got to the cup final and they had to play the game in Russia 3 days before, fly back from Russia and play in a cup final on Sunday, and they did that as well. So Stephen has history here in terms of trying to deal with those challenges. And of course he's fighting his corner. But the other thing with Stephen Kenny, and people will know this over his last 2 or 3 years in managing the Irish team and how passionate he is about Irish football and trying it to grow and obviously get better, he cares an awful lot, and he's genuinely, his care comes from the right place, Marie. All the managers will be selfish for their own interests. All the clubs will be selfish for their own interests. But I genuinely believe him when he says, for the greater good of the game to grow it and have two teams in a group stage, he cares. I know for a fact he cares.
Okay, well, people, send us in your thoughts, 51552. Do you think that it was the right call for the St. Pat's Dundalk game to be postponed? So let's get on to last night's matches, Alan. We mentioned just how encouraging it was to watch St. Pat's last night and the display that they put in. But even when you think that so far in this European campaign they've played 5 games and they remain unbeaten and they've only conceded 3 goals, and they've just been really well set up, is it a case that Stephen has, I suppose, a special skill almost in being able to navigate these European journeys?
It's his thing, yeah. I think he reached a milestone in 50 games, I think it is, in Europe now that he's managed prior to last night's game. So he has huge experience in that regard. And in a lot of those cases, there would have been, all his teams would have been an underdog going into a lot of those games, Marie. And here is the perfect situation and the perfect scenario again, where last night there would have been big underdogs. But yet he's able to set them up, as you say. He's able to create, I suppose, a mindset amongst the groups, whatever he's had, Dundalk, now at St. Pat's, amongst the group of players, that making them believe, making them feel 10 foot tall, that they can go out on that stage and perform and do very well. And when you think a 16-year-old was leading the line last night for the Marie and put in a brilliant, brilliant performance, and people will hear plenty about this kid as things go on, Mason Melia was brilliant. So he deserves massive amounts of credit, Stephen. As you say, it's their fifth European game. This was the toughest by far against a team who's operating at a level way above St. Pat's in terms of resources and budgets and being in group stages over the last 2, 3, 4 years. I think it's a massive, massive result. Do I think it'll be enough to get them through next week? I'm not sure. I don't think it will, because it's such a tough ask. Yeah. But they've given themselves a chance, and that's the most important thing, Marie, going into next week.
I was listening to Stephen Kenny talking about it, and he was saying it's not like they're heading into like a massive cauldron over there. They don't get huge fans. It's not going to be a case where they'll be totally overwhelmed by a massive crowd in a fortress or anything like that. So he does seem to be well aware that it might be a challenge that they could overcome.
Yeah, and that's the belief that he will give them. And I believed him, basically. Yeah, what he's referring to there, Marie, is we covered the game during the week, Galatasaray, and obviously they're famous for welcome to hell type thing. And we spoke about young boys needing a score or needing some sort of an advantage going over there, because obviously what they're going to be faced with in terms of the hostility that we normally see with the likes of a Galatasaray or a Fenerbahce, it won't be the same. And as Stephen said, the crowd obviously won't be the same, which is, again, it's an advantage for, you would hope, for St. Pat's, that they shouldn't be feared. This team that they're playing against, they obviously got a look at them last night, and they've given themselves a chance. That's the most, the positive thing I can say about it, Marie, in the sense that if you're playing in a two-legged tie against superior opposition, that if you're going into the second leg still very much fighting, and they are very much fighting. And of course, on the flip side of that is whether they, I wouldn't say gave them the respect they deserve, or whether they did or not, we don't know. You'd have to speak to, obviously, the Bakakashire's manager to find that out. But whether they did or whether they didn't, they would have got a look at those players last night, St. Pat's, and they would have known now coming into next week that they'll have to be very much on their guard as well, going into that game, because St. Pat's have very, very good players, creative players, attacking players. Mulroney can change a game in a moment, set pieces. Forrester, we all know the brilliance that he has. The young kid Melia now up front as well. So they'll be very much on their guard as well. And I keep going back to it, they've given themselves a chance. And with Stephen in charge, we've seen him pull off massive results before with teams like this, Marie. Who knows? I just think it'll be too big of an ask, but I'm delighted to see that the result they got last night, the league has looked after them a little bit and given them the game off on Sunday to prepare properly and get themselves ready for it. And as I say, if we were to get another team into the group stage, it would be unbelievable for the league.
Make sense of the fact that they can put these performances consistently together in Europe, but we don't see the same form from St. Pat's in the league.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, everybody expected when Stephen came in that we would see this big massive bounce from them, but that takes time as well, Marie, and he's only really kind of putting his team together, if you like. I saw them 2 weeks ago, was it, against Sligo Rovers, and they were unrecognisable from the team that started the season. So he's still only putting his team together and bringing in the signings that he wants. The goalkeeper obviously has come in, the lad that got injured last night, Palmer, he'll be a miss now in the second leg. So he's only putting his side together. before long, don't you worry, you'll see St. Pat's up near the top, Marie. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. And now to have the influx of money coming from the European adventure that they've been on, which is massive for them. They have a very sound backer in Gareth Keller, who always supports them and always invests heavily in the club and the squad and supports them. He's gone big on investing with Stephen Kenny in terms of putting all his, I wouldn't say putting all his eggs in one basket, but you look at the length of contract that they've given Stephen. So they're really saying this is for the long term. And as I said to you a moment ago, it won't be long before I see St. Pat's back up there challenging with Shamrock Rovers or Shelburne or Derry, whoever it is.
How long do you think they'll be able to keep Mason Melia from? He got so much love last night for his performance, but even the opponents putting him up on their social media saying like, this kid is 16.
Yeah, 16 is phenomenal. I can't, like, 16, what were you doing when you were 16?
I wasn't doing much now. I can't even remember.
You weren't
remember.
Performing in Europe,
absolutely
anyway.
Not, yeah,
against
yeah.
the Turkish team that just played in the Europa League group stage or Champions League. No, it is. It's phenomenal. Fair. And we've seen him obviously playing in the league, and even at that, that's a hell of an achievement to play in our league at 16. But to play on the European stage against seasoned pros, seasoned campaigners, and perform in the manner that he did, that is the big. It's not that it's a problem for St. Pat's or for the league here. The best players go away. That's been happening forever, Marie. And if his ceiling obviously has nowhere near been reached yet, he will go away. We all know that. But at the moment, he's doing everything that he can to perform for St. Pat's. They're giving him that platform. And whilst they have him, let him run riot. And that's exactly what he's doing, the young lad, in fairness to him.
The comments from Stephen Kenny after about him, I thought were just really impressive, because he's talking about his work out of possession and how good his attitude is, and like, he's got top class centre backs coming at him, but he doesn't care. Like, he just keeps going, has this brilliant attitude, fights for everything, works hard, and it's so hard to put that into players, but he just seems to have it in spades, as well as the talent.
Yeah, and I always say that to young kids, that if you have the attitude, that will serve you so well going forward. It's one thing to have talent, but if you can't back it up with your attitude, well, then you'll be found wanting. So if he has the two of them like he has, I still think there's huge room for improvement. I've watched him many times. He's very raw technically. He needs to improve on a lot of things, but in terms of, going back to that point you're making, Marie, the attitude and the desire and the hunger that he has, he's already two steps ahead of a lot of lads that may be technically a little bit better. And the fact that he's playing in the league now, he's getting the guidance from Stephen, the coaching, to be fair, the coaching team that's been around St. Pat's, their academy setup is very, very good, and he's come through that as well. So yeah, good luck to the kid. He will go away. We've seen it last year with Sam Curtis. Yeah. How many games did he play? He went away. He will go away in time. But while he's here and performing at the level that he's performing, and learning from Stephen as well. Stephen will, again, we go back to, not only does Stephen care about Irish football, but he'll care about the young lad as a person and as a human, and want to see him perform and do well, and also try and give him as much guidance as to where he should go. Also, we see so many young lads with talent go away, not make the right decisions, maybe be guided by agents, guided by whoever wrongly, and all of a sudden find themselves back here in 2 or 3 years. Nobody will want to see that either. They'll want to see the young fella, when he does go, progress, because it'll be a reflection of St. Pat's as well if he goes on and does really well in his career. But for him to perform on the stage that he did last night and do as well as he did, he deserves enormous credit.
Yeah, he's justifying his selection anyway, week after week. Shamrock Rovers is just outclassed.
Yeah, and I said this last week here, Marie. I watched Shamrock Rovers against Drogheda 2 Sundays ago, and they should have been beaten. And then they went out and beat the team from Slovenia, and it was a great result. But facing up against that Europa League playoff against Pauk, I always thought it was going to be a bridge too far. And it's not the worst result in the world in terms of, they're in the group stage of the Conference League. They've guaranteed that already. That's their level. And I say that in the nicest possible way, in the sense that they're a very, very good team, Shamrock Rovers, with brilliant players. They actually have a real opportunity of doing something in the group stage, Marie, because if you find the inconsistency that they've showed all year and the disappointing season that they've had in the league, now they can focus all their efforts on the Europa League group stage, on the Conference League group stage, and actually do some damage in it and win a couple of games. The money is not too different in terms of the bonuses that they'll get for winning a game, whereas I think if they were to go into the Europa League proper group stage, they might have got a couple of glamour ties, but I felt they would have been struggling in each game. Whereas now in the Conference League, you'll be playing against teams of a similar standard, countries of a similar size. It's been, let's be honest, the reason they brought in the Conference League group stage was for countries of the size of us, and for clubs like Shamrock Rovers or St. Pat's or wherever, to obviously dip into that financial reward that Europe brings. And I don't think it'll be a bad thing for them. And I said it even a few weeks ago about the league form, that they'll still feel as though they might be in the league race, and who knows, they might be. But I think they can actually, if you think the last time they were in the group stage, Marie, and they were playing second string teams in a lot of cases because they were still going for the league. They couldn't really have a crack at the group stage, whereas they will be able to focus solely now on the Conference League group stage, and I think they have a real chance of doing some damage.
Okay, well, lots to look forward to on that one. There are three League of Ireland games this evening as well. Shells and Bows is the big one. We're going to be talking to Alan about that in just a while. But now we're turning our attention to the Premier League. And I'm delighted to say that Fergal Brennan and Peter Smith are with us as well. Fergal, to you first, because I haven't talked to you in ages. Liverpool up and running, playing Brentford this weekend. Have you been impressed with Arne Slot?
Yeah, it's always going to be such a strange situation of kind of dealing with a new Liverpool manager, press conferences, build up to games when Jurgen Klopp has been in, or rather was in position for so long. The dealings that I've had with Arne Slot in terms of the way that he operates with journalists and the way that he kind of puts himself across has been really positive. He has looked over the summer to change some things and put his own stamp on the team, particularly in terms of the way that they play. That's come out from quite a few players over the summer that it's very different from Jurgen Klopp. The kind of heavy metal football is not really the way that he wants to go about things. He wants to be a bit more structured and a bit more possession based. Obviously there's such a small body of work so far pre-season. I'm never a big fan of taking too much from it and putting too much stock in terms of performances and results, but last weekend against Ipswich, the game kind of followed the pattern that we expected, that Ipswich will be hyped up because they're back in the Premier League after so long away. Liverpool, with the quality and experience that they have, needed to weather a bit of a storm and kind of not let the occasion be the dominant theme, and then just let that standard of individuals that they've got go and win the game. And that's exactly what happened. It's obviously a different situation this weekend at home. Slot's first home game in the Premier League as Liverpool manager. It'll be a full house. The weather is meant to be really good here over the weekend. The storm that's meant to be coming in is probably going to hold off, so that it should be all nice and sunny for Slot. Brentford did get a win themselves on the opening weekend, but there's lots of rumours swirling around. Ivan Toney unlikely to be involved. Thomas Frank's effectively had to say that he doesn't know what's going to happen in the next week, whether he'll still be a Brentford player at the start of September. So confident of a Liverpool home win. That'll be another big one for Arne Slot, because there's still some doubts about him because of what Klopp has built at Liverpool. But the early signs have looked really, really positive. The main focus after this weekend will be, can they get a player in? That kind of thing is hanging over them, that they're the only Premier League team not to make a signing so far this summer. They've obviously fell short in getting in Zubimendi. He will be a bit anxious to get somebody in, but they can't make the mistake of just bringing someone in out of panic and kind of out of the sake of it. But I'd be very positive that they'll get a win this weekend, two in a row, get to the international break in September with lots of positivity.
I think when I saw Salah and how fit he looked, I didn't think he could look any fitter than he did before, but he just looks in unbelievable shape. It doesn't seem to be as maybe worrying, maybe when you see Alan, just how well he's looking coming back into the season.
He looks so sharp, because I actually had a concern that Salah might leave.
Yeah, same.
Off the back of Klopp leaving, and it was almost as if I felt as though they had kind of some sort of unwritten agreement between themselves that Klopp might have said to Salah last year, look, there's a good chance I'll be gone, and just give me one good year. And then there was a bit of friction with them towards the end of the season as well. So that kind of played into my thoughts then, thinking he might go as well. But the shape and the condition that he's come back in, you're right, Marie, he looks magnificent. And I thought Liverpool looked magnificent in the second half last week. They were brilliant. And I know Fergal touched on the fact that they haven't made a sign-in and is there concerns. I don't think there is, because they still have a very, very strong squad. And the one thing I like about Liverpool as well, they don't panic buy in. They won't just kind of go into the market for someone that they don't want. Unless it's the right fit and the right player, they won't sign him. And that's the right approach to have. So the second half, I thought they were absolutely brilliant in the game last week. It was tricky enough the first half, as you'd expect Ipswich just back in the Premier League. But I still think Liverpool have a very strong season. Do I think they'll challenge? Not really in terms of winning the league, because I still think City and Arsenal are a little bit ahead of them. But in terms of the new manager and getting off to a good start, and like Fergal said, I think they'll win on Sunday as well. I wouldn't have too many concerns or worries. I think he's slotted in, pardon the pun, but I think he has slotted in quite seamlessly, and the players look as though they've responded to it as well, and they looked very good in that second half.
Fergal, there is a lot of concern about the fact that Liverpool are selling quite a number of their younger players, or maybe the talent that they've brought through. And I know Arne Slot was asked about it in his press conference today, and he was just able to, I suppose, kind of give a bit of a general answer about players and positions and time and minutes and all that sort of stuff. What do you think about it?
I think the club and the manager are kind of operating in two different situations here. The club know that if it's a sensible business decision to sell on a player for a good transfer fee, that's what they're going to do. We've seen that with Bobby Clark going to Salzburg earlier in the week, and Sepp van der Berg going to Brentford. I think some fans will look at it and say these are players that are being either produced by the club or, as you say, coming through, haven't been bought at a young age. But I just think it's the cutthroat nature of Premier League football. And you look at the back end of last season, there was so much attention around these young players that Jurgen Klopp had thrown into games. They played in a cup final and some European action. The reality is it's still very unlikely that any of them are going to go on to be Premier League level players at Liverpool. That sounds harsh, but it is just the truth. And I think we've seen that so far with Arne Slot. A lot of those players, up to a dozen of them that got some minutes under Klopp at the end of last season, have barely featured. And you're looking at maybe one or two that might make the grade. And when I say make the grade, I don't mean being a professional footballer or even being a Premier League footballer. I mean being a Premier League level player for Liverpool. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Curtis Jones are two examples in the last best part of a decade that have come through and managed to be Premier League level players. That's how hard it is to be at the level that Liverpool will demand, not just under Klopp previously, but now under Arne Slot. And they are trying to run a kind of sensible business model behind the scenes. I know that's frustrating for supporters who want to see new players coming in, and they want to see kids breaking through and going on and being first team players. But there's a huge amount of metrics to get looked at in these types of situations. And 90%+ of the time, the right decision is made. There will be a conversation that's gone on behind the scenes about someone like Bobby Clark or Van der Berg, where it's looked at it and gone, yes, they're a very good player. Are they going to be something that is an asset to the club? And that sounds all kind of impersonal, but that's how these things are framed up. And Slot, even though he's new to the job, he will have had an input on that, will have had a look at these players over pre-season and will have made that call. Whether that money then gets moved into a big transfer in the final days of the window, that remains to be seen. But I think it's just a cutthroat nature of the Premier League, particularly at the real, real sharp end. And Liverpool are involved in that. I'd agree with Alan that they are still somewhat short in terms of a title challenge, but they're still one of the best teams in the Premier League. And that's the level that players need to reach if they are going to break in.
I think it's just so difficult for young kids, Marie. And if you go back to that League Cup final where so many of them featured and everybody, but you won't get 8, 9, 10 through. If you think last week the midfield three that started for Liverpool and how stacked it is with McAllister, Szoboszlai, and who was the other one, Fergal, that started?
You've actually caught me out there. Endo? Did he start?
So you've those three, right? And the money that was paid for them, if you look at the likes of Curtis Jones and Harvey Elliott, who have featured a lot, I'd say Curtis Jones has probably played 60, 70 games, Harvey Elliott something similar, and yet still there's question marks over them in terms of starting every week, and they're kind of still on the fringes, and now there's a new manager come in to have to prove it to him. So if you think of those lads that are still trying to make their way, and yet you've a young lad like Bobby Clark or Van der Berg during the week who have had no minutes whatsoever, but yet the club are getting in the region of, I think it was 25 million for Van der Berg and 10 was it for Bobby Clark. That's phenomenal money, Marie, for lads that haven't even kicked the ball. So it's incredible piece of business, I think, from Liverpool. And if that gets reinvested then into the first team squad for Slot or whatever, I think that's their job done, Liverpool. Those lads might still go on. They've had their education at Liverpool. They'll go on, have a good career in the game, if you like, with the likes of Brentford where Van der Berg is gone or wherever Clark. And I think Liverpool have done their job there, and they've made money for the club, and they've also educated the young lads that they'll go out and it's no bad thing that they haven't come through. Maybe you're not going to get them all through, you might only get 1, 2, 3 through, and they're the exceptional ones. So I think when I read that news during the week about Van den Berg, I thought that was an unbelievable piece of business.
Peter Smith is with us as well. What do you think, Peter?
I think as well it helps Liverpool's profit and sustainability, doesn't it? Because selling players that you've made as homegrown, it shows really well on the balance sheet. So it's good all round. Really interested to listen to you, Alan and Marie, talking about young Irish talent and the way that the League of Ireland are doing in the European competitions. You know, I'm really pleased to say that there's quite a lot of young players from Ireland doing well over here in England. I watched Cathal Heffernan play for Newcastle under-21s on Monday. And last season at EFL level, at Lincoln City, people like Mondreo and Fleetwood Town, who've got an affinity with Waterford. I'm going to be covering Fleetwood in a couple of weeks. So many Irish lads at Fleetwood Town at the moment, and players who've got a chance. You know, so I'm really encouraged that League of Ireland players are establishing themselves over this side of the water as well, and proving competitive too. I think it's very, very encouraging.
The point that's been made about that quite often here, Peter, is that Irish players are moving away, and they're moving away for real small money. So if you're bringing in a player from Brazil and you're paying 5 or 6 million for them, and then only paying small money for an Irish player, and Al, you'll probably have a thought on this, that they're going to start playing the guy that they've played a huge amount of money for, because they've invested in that person. Mm. So to them, if they want to prove their business acumen and that they've picked the right person, they're going to start playing that big money player over maybe the League of Ireland player that they've paid way smaller for.
Yeah, and it's an age-old argument, Marie, really, in terms of, I suppose, the money that we get for our players and the compensation. And you only have to go back to Seamus Coleman, Peter. Mm. 60,000, probably the best 60,000 Everton have ever spent in their life. But all throughout, even going back since Seamus and all the years through, it's a pittance, really, the players, the money. And what they're trying to do now, Peter, is we've set up academy systems, if you like, where there's a pathway for all the League of Ireland clubs of underage teams now. And that if they obviously see a lad, the likes of Gavin Bazunu, Shamrock Rovers, he's probably the best example. If the club here see talent in a lad at 14, 15, 16, like real talent, the likes of Mason Mealy, that you think this Sam lad Purchase is going to go on and have a really good career, they try to nail them down to longer term contracts or professional contracts as soon as they can, so that when the club do come in for them at 17, 18, whatever the age may be, and it's 18 now if you're going to England, or if it's younger if you're going to Europe, that they will get the compensation that they're due in terms of what their development has cost the club and what the potential for sell on fees and stuff like that is. So we've been caught out in a lot of instances, Peter, but it's good to see that finally we're cottoning on to that, and obviously when the lads go away, that the clubs will be reimbursed properly.
Yeah, and there's more value.
No, I understand where you're coming from, Al. I really understand what you're saying, and I'm glad that process is in place, because obviously that money needs to be regenerated for your future development of players. But the point being that someone who watches a bit of EFL League One and League Two football, as well as Premier League football, I like to see a young Irish lad do well, you know, and the fact that they can come over and play at this level of football and make an impression and make an improvement, you know, that's what I'm saying. I'm encouraged, you know, because we see so many overseas players coming. You mentioned the South Americans, and they're coming from all areas. It's a global game now, and so hard for English and Irish young players to progress in the professional game. And so when I see lads from Ireland doing well, I'm always encouraged by it.
We might get you on a regular report from the lower leagues. That'd be great, Peter. Peter, we were talking about Liverpool there and them playing Ipswich last week. Poor Ipswich up to the Premier League, and they have Liverpool followed by Man City. It's a bit of a rough reintroduction, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially when you consider that there's one man who'll be on the pitch tomorrow who's got a collection to complete, and that's Erling Haaland. He's scored 91 goals now, Marie, in 100 games for City. You know, when we sort of marvel at somebody who's got a 1-2 goal record, or even have a real high respect for a 1-3 record. I mean, 91 in 100. And he's scored against every single Premier League club that he's played against. So 22 different Premier League teams he's played against. He's netted against all 22 of them in the last couple of seasons. Ipswich are the only current Premier League team that he hasn't played against, so I'm sure he'll be hungry for a goal tomorrow to make sure it's 23 out of 23. But what a phenomenon that is, isn't it? 91 in 100.
Do we, Peter, nearly take him for granted now? Because there would have been a time, as you say, when a 1-2 record, 1-3, and everybody wasn't speaking. This fella is doing remarkable things, but because it's almost normalised, we don't really go, I suppose, get as excited as what we were maybe 2-3 years ago with him.
I think we should do, Alan, because
that's what I'm saying.
I think
that's my point.
Yeah. I think he's going to be one of the best ever. I think he's going to be one of the greatest ever goal scorers in the history of the game. And, you know, you look at the different types of goals that he scores and his movement off the ball and the way that he gets into the right positions and senses what's coming from midfield. I mean, when I was growing up as a kid, because my late grandfather was a Manxman and he worked in Liverpool in his late teens and early 20s, he saw Dixie Dean. So he used to tell me the legend of Dixie Dean when I was a young kid, you know, and about those 60 goals in a season. I've always carried that with me, always sort of had respect for Dixie Dean and Everton, and I wonder how brilliant he was. But I probably think that Erling Haaland is going to be as near to Dixie Dean in terms of perfection as a striker as there's ever going to be. He for me, he's one of the best I've ever seen already at his age. I don't know whether we can ever climb into that sort of Messi Ronaldo type of hysteria, if you know what I mean. But yeah. I don't think he's going to be far off it. I think if you have a notch down from those two, I reckon over the course of the next two or three seasons, he will be looked back upon and regarded in the next breath down as greatest ever. That's how good he is.
Great Sligo Rovers links with Dixie Dean, the boots buried under the showgrounds. There's another Irish link for you, Peter.
I'll tell you what, Sligo Rovers will do for me, Al. I know you've got an affinity with that particular part of the world, but if it's good enough for Dixie and you, Alan, it's good enough for me.
Lovely, Peter.
Fergal, I was away last week, and just on the point of whether or not Alan would reach that hysteria of Messi Ronaldo, and it wasn't I was in Spain, and you know, all the little kids with the jerseys, and it was very much Lamine Yamal. There was the Messi jerseys weren't as prominent, like every little kid had Lamine Yamal on the back of the jersey. It was quite amazing to see. Do you think that Haaland, he didn't seem to feature that much, but do you think that he'll reach those heights?
I think I'd agree with the majority of what Peter said there. I think he's moving in that direction. I just think that until we're past Messi and Ronaldo in terms of their playing career, until they're both retired and we move into this next phase, because football has been for so long dominated by the two of them, the arguments over who's the best, who's the greatest of all time, etc., that everybody's been mentioned with that little asterisk next to them of, yeah, but outside of Messi and Ronaldo, are they in the conversation? And I think when you look at the players over the last 10 years that have been the closest to them, Suarez, Benzema, Lewandowski, I think Haaland absolutely can be in that conversation. When you think of Suarez's best season at Barcelona or Lewandowski's best seasons with Bayern Munich, yeah, what Haaland is doing at Manchester City is certainly in that mould. I think maybe the only thing that might hold him back in terms of being mentioned as one of the greatest ever is that I think he'd be mentioned as one of the greatest ever goal scorers, because he's kind of one for the purists in that sense that the big majority of his game is about scoring goals and almost kind of like an old-fashioned way. He's not a Karim Benzema who's an incredible goal scorer but that does other stuff that links in with the team. He does his work and he works hard and links up with the midfield, but he's very much, I score goals. You get the ball to me and I will score goals. And the old cliche of that being the hardest thing, there is a lot of truth in that. But I think maybe that's something that might keep him away from that conversation personally, because Ronaldo's probably viewed as more of a pure goal scorer than Messi, but both of them have got these unbelievable goal scoring numbers, as well as being able to do things in games that no one else can do. I think maybe that's what keeps Haaland away from that conversation, because he's seen as incredible at one or two things, but the wider package, just for me personally, just doesn't reach other players, and I'm not even including Messi and Ronaldo in that.
I think he's starting to show a bit more of his personality as well. I did like his interaction with Cucurella last week. I'll get a bit of a kick out of that, which I think is important as well when you're trying to maybe bridge that gap of hysteria, that people do get to know you a little bit and get to see what you're about. And I think we are seeing a little bit more of Haaland. Peter, Brighton and United, really hard to know with where Manchester United are, because I know that there's people already talking about when Ten Hag is going to get sacked and that. But even from Brighton's perspective, they've been, I don't know if I expected them to start so well.
Well, he's got a 100% record this season as Eric Ten Hag, Maurice, so
he's a few more games in him yet.
Well, it was interesting watching last week the way that he played, the system that he played, the fact that he was sort of pushing Mount and pushing on
Bruno Fernandes, wasn't it?
Bruno Fernandes, the central strikers, you know, sort of like the false nine, as we call them in the game now. You know, and getting Diallo and Rashford to come in off the flanks and support. That was interesting to see two midfielders popping up in the centre-forward position. It wasn't overly spectacular. Maybe you'll say substitutions were good last week against Fulham. He introduced Xerxes after an hour, and he obviously popped up and scored the match-winning goal. But it's a definite test tomorrow against Brighton. They're a well-run football club. A lot's been made about the fact that their new manager, Fabian Hertzler, at 31 years of age, has got a win under his belt already. Although he says that even though he's 31, he's been a coach for 10 years, so shouldn't necessarily be viewed as a young coach strictly because of the decade experience that he's got under his belt. But yeah, certainly from a Manchester United point of view, Brighton away is a challenging game for them. But if they're going to be serious top four contenders, they've got to be winning at places like that. That is for sure. They have to find proper consistency and tee themselves up without defeat from their point of view, you would have thought, for that big game against Liverpool coming up the weekend after this one.
Wow, they're coming really quick, aren't they? Fergal, we're just going to finish up in the Premier League, and one word on Jude Bellingham. He has emerged now as an injury doubt for next month's Nations League opener against the Republic of Ireland in Dublin. And am I correct as well in saying that Lee Carsley has added a few people to his backroom team?
Yeah, there's been big changes in terms of removing some of the kind of trusted lieutenants of Gareth Southgate's era. Steve Holland probably being the big name that people will recognise, who was always on the bench, kind of had Southgate's ear during his time in charge. And Lee Carsley, even though he is interim boss, he's looked to change a few things. I think probably looking to push his case for the job on a permanent basis. He knows that he's firmly in the running. He knows that these games will be an opportunity for him to make his case to the FA. They've effectively said that the rest of the Nations League games between now and the end of 2024, he will be in charge for. That just needs kind of ticking off in the next few weeks. I think the interesting thing you mentioned there, Bellingham, will be which players are available. So many top managers, Carlo Ancelotti being one of them, have bemoaned the lack of a break over the summer and the fact that the season is going to stretch on with the Club World Cup next summer and then the World Cup in the summer of 2026. So I imagine that's going to be the biggest battle for him. Speaking to players, speaking to club managers, striking deals, negotiating, being a bit of a diplomat, because he knows that the Nations League is kind of seen as a bit... by some players and some national team, club managers. Bellingham will miss out. He certainly won't be the only England player not to play against Ireland and probably for the rest of the Nations League games this year. That will be an issue for Lee Carsley. And it's obviously just something that he has to balance because he knows that this is his chance to prove himself to get the job. Bellingham, bit of a blow for England, bit of a blow for Real Madrid as well. Carlo Ancelotti's also said that he's going to bring in player holidays in and around the international break. So when players go away, when they come back, they won't train for 4 or 5 days and then they will probably play the next game. He said that's the only way that they can do it. And I think we might see that in the Premier League as well, Guardiola, Arteta, etc. Because it is just such a packed schedule and Bellingham's just the first high-profile injury that we've heard. There's going to be a lot of this in the first few weeks of the season.
This is a blessing in disguise for Bellingham, Marie, because we're there. This is going to rage, I suppose, in the next 3, 4, 5 months when you think of the schedule. And as I said, I watched him last week in the Super Cup. Now, he was brilliant in the second half, Bellingham, but this will actually be a blessing in disguise for him because we're flogging the Stars and it's not right what's happening at the moment in terms of the schedule, Marie. So for Bellingham to get a bit of a break now, it'll actually help him.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break ourselves because we've been so flat out. Alan, stay with us. Peter and Fergal, thank you so much for joining us. Big weekend in the Premier League. They're all big now. We'll be back after these. We're going to be chatting to Shane Stokes, Maeve DeBerke, Jane Mangan, and Alan's going to preview tonight's League of Ireland games as well. 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Hello, welcome back. We're turning our attention to cycling, and Belgian Wout van Aert sprinted to win stage 7 of the Vuelta a España today, his second victory of this year's race, with Australia's Ben O'Connor retaining the overall lead. And to talk us through how the day unfolded, I'm delighted to say that Shane Stokes joins us now. Shane, what was today like?
Yeah, today was a stage that looked quite lumpy, but lacked really huge climbs that you often see in Grand Tours, but it was probably more selective than expected. There was a second category climb quite close to the finish, and that proved really decisive. Yesterday, you saw Ben O'Connor taking a really dominant win and putting a lot of time between himself and Primoz Roglic, who's the three-time winner and probably the favourite for this year's race. And Roglic and his team were out to try and prove a point today, made the pace really tough on this climb towards the finish and reduced the list of contenders with several big names going out the back. Yeah, it was a very decisive day. It ended up being a bunch sprint or a group sprint of 33 riders, with Wout van Aert taking the stage win and Ireland's Eddie Dunbar finishing in that group, rolling in 14th place and just looking good. He looks like he's settling into the race well. He suffered in the heat early on in the race. It's still really hot. They were down in Cordoba, which is one of the hottest parts of Spain, but Dunbar seems to be getting used to the temperatures and looking stronger.
That sounds really positive from Dunbar's perspective. What's the potential for him in this race, do you think?
Well, he went in, he finished last year in the Giro d'Italia last year, so about a year and 3 months ago or so, he finished seventh overall, and he had been sitting fourth overall with 3 days to go. That was his first time to lead a team in a three-week tour, and only his second time to do a three-week tour. So that was very, very promising, and he went into this probably a little bit short of that form, but hoping to ride into form and looking ideally, I suppose, for a top 10 overall. But he lost time early in the race because of the heat. A few days ago, he slipped right back. But he's looking very solid, and I think he can still do something very good in this race if he continues to progress the way he's progressing. What's interesting is that a lot of this race has been run off in a lot of heat and is down south, but it's moving north and it will be a lot cooler. So I would expect that he will fare better under those climatic conditions.
Yeah, fair enough. I think we all probably would in that situation. Sure. So tell me about Archie Ryan then, how he's getting on in Germany.
Yeah, so Archie Ryan is a first-year professional. He's with the EF Education Easy Post team, really talented climber. He's from Wicklow. He did very well as an amateur, and he's mixing it with the professionals today in his first pro season. So he was on the attack again on stage three of the Deutschland Tour in Germany. He sparked off a breakaway with 44 kilometres to go, and that proved to be the day's decisive move with a number of other, actually quite a large group coming back up to them. And then with 1.7 kilometres to go, there was a bonus sprint on a climb, and Ryan attacked, finished second to Mads Pedersen in that bonus sprint, and then finished third behind Mads Pedersen and one other rider who had joined them at the finish. And it's just very good performance because it's not terrain that suits Ryan. He's a really light rider. He's probably about 55 kilos or so. He would definitely thrive on hillier terrain, but he's making the most of it. And he jumped from 47 places to fourth overall with 2 days remaining, which is really promising. Again, he'd prefer the next 2 days don't have huge climbs. He would prefer it to be tougher again, but he's still just really impressing in this first year as a pro. And I think his team are quite excited about him.
It sounds like himself and Darren Rafferty are really exciting talents.
That's right, yeah. Darren is a teammate and he's also a first-year pro. He's with the EF Education Easy Post, so with the same team. And the two of them just have really clicked. They were really strong as amateurs and they've really clicked. Sometimes it takes riders a year or two or even three to settle in once they move up to the professional ranks. But both Archie Ryan and Darren Rafferty have been really, you know, being very, very solid this year, being aggressive, riding strongly. And I think they have both got really exciting careers ahead of them.
So what's coming up tomorrow then for the Vuelta?
For the Vuelta, yeah. So it's definitely a tougher stage tomorrow. There's a proper summit finish. Not a huge, not as high as you might see later in the race, but there's still a really stiff climb towards at the finish of the race. It's into Cazorla. There's a third category climb, but it's very steep at the end. I think there could be time gaps all right, and I think Primoz Roglic will again be trying to take time from Ben O'Connor. And then the following day there's a stage to Granada, which does have a downhill finish, but there's a lot of climbs in that. There's three first category climbs and that too could be decisive.
Okay, Shane, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on all of that. It's time now to turn our attention to racing though, and I'm delighted to say that Jane Mangan joins us. Jane, were you sitting around watching York for the day?
You know what? I'm here in York, Marie, and I have been here. I've been here for the week, and that day on Wednesday felt a little bit like the Tuesday of Cheltenham, because we had the Voltigeur where Los Angeles read the script and beat his stable companion Illinois. We had the Acomb Stakes where Aidan O'Brien's 2-year-old The Lion in Winter broke a track record, And then reading the script completely to the letter was City of Troy and Ryan Moore, with those change of tactics, making all and again breaking See the Stars time, record time in the Judmont International. And as if it couldn't get any better, and people talk about Ireland's domination in national hunt terms, small trainer, small family, Pat O'Donnell gets in on the act in the 100 grand handicap with Joey Sheridan, with Extensio. That was all on the Wednesday. It couldn't get any better, could it? Well, the Yorkshire Oaks yesterday, content, Emily Upjohn, and Rafe Beckett's filly. It looked like a three-way, you know, pronged attack for the Yorkshire Oaks, but Ryan Moore just decided he was going to do his own thing, stay on the inside, race on his own, and content, bagged another Group 1 for O'Brien and Moore. So it rolled on into today, where we didn't really have a strong hand, and Holly Doyle won the Nunthorpe with Bradzell. But so far, the racing at York has been pretty splendid.
Jane, just in terms of Ryan Moore, and I watched it yesterday, and when you think of how much the horse pulled his head, content, and he couldn't settle him, and you said then went up the inside, and it was almost as if you think, because he was so unsettled at the start of the race, how could he win? And the day that he had the day before Ryan Moore, like, we've had Frankie Dettori, Lester Pickett, all these amazing jockeys over the years, the world's best. Like, he must be coming near the realm of up there with the best ever, is he?
Yeah, he's the best at the moment in the world. I heard you guys talking about, you know, quantifying soccer players in terms of Messi and Ronaldo, and whether they get to the level of a Pickett or a Dettori. Ryan is definitely there. He's what those people do, whatever sport they're in, they make a positive difference. There's a lot of riders, there's a lot of sports people who can get the job done when they're given the materials to do it, but this guy can win on horses that shouldn't win. And yes, he's got probably the highest pressure job in the world. He's riding some of the most expensive horses in the world. But he's making decisions and manoeuvres and tactics that people just don't consider until after they see him do it and realise, oh, that was the right place to be. That was the right thing to do. And he's making, as I said on the coverage yesterday, I think he's making the extraordinary look ordinary. He's making it those decisions so regularly that we come to expect it from him now. And that isn't the case with anybody else.
So what else is coming up then for you and for York, Jane?
Yeah, so tomorrow the group racing really is over, and the concentration turns to the Ebor Handicap, which is worth around 300 grand to the winner. There's a five-pronged Irish attack led by Queenstown for Aidan O'Brien. He's the mount of James Doyle. Colin Keane's travelling over for Willie Mullins, who actually, I must mention, William Mullins took the Lonsdale Cup today with Vauban, William Buick taking the ride on him, and it looks like that he has booked his ticket to Melbourne off the back of that Lonsdale Cup win. Magical Zoe's in the Ebor as well for Henry de Bromhead, amongst Jessica Harrington's and my mate Mozzie for Gavin Cromwell, Jessica Harrington's other runner, which is Yashin. But closer to home, it's worth mentioning, obviously it's Killarney and the Kilbegan and the Curragh this weekend, but the two main races at the Curragh, the Futurity and the Debutante. These are for the two-year-olds. We saw a very impressive performance from Aline in winter. Well, Aidan O'Brien isn't short of talent in the two-year-old bracket. He's got Henri Matisse and A Rock of Cashel. Henri Matisse, who won... he won the Railway really impressively last time at the Curragh over course and distance. He meets Jessica Harrington's Tyros winner, Hot as Hell. It looks like it's between the pair of them. And half an hour later, it's the Debutante Stakes, where I think the best two-year-old in training, Bedtime Story, looks a very short, prohibited odds. Aidan O'Brien is the top three in the betting. It's not one for the punters to get involved in. It's maybe one to sit back and try and quantify whether Bedtime Story is the next big thing.
Jane, thank you so much. As always, enjoy the next few days, and we'll be talking to you very soon. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be previewing the Women's FAI Cup quarterfinals.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM.
So over the weekend, eight teams will be whittled down to four, with the quarterfinals of the Sports Direct Women's FAI Cup down for a decision. DLR Waves taking on Sligo, Cork City Bohemians, Treaty United at Lone Town, and then on Monday it is Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne. And to talk us through how these may unfold, I'm delighted to say that Maeve de Burka is with us on the line. Maeve, the big one really is Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's the standout game, I think, of all the quarterfinals, really, on Monday night. Obviously, Rovers lost the All-Ireland Cup final last weekend on penalties to Galway, and I suppose they'll be looking to, you know, bounce back after that. And Shells lost their last match too. They lost at Lone in the league, so they're only the second now in the league at the moment. So, yeah, hopefully, I suppose they'll be looking maybe to do the double this year. Shells are still in a shout with both the league and the cup.
And what about the other game? So we've DLR and Sligo.
Yeah, I suppose Sligo are the only team in the league not to have won yet this season. So their only win of the season came last weekend in the first round of the cup against Terenure. They beat them 5-0. So then they're up against obviously DLR, and I mean they've had a disappointing season. Really, they're second from bottom in the league as well. So that's kind of, you know, it'll be a big result whoever gets through to the semi final out of that one.
Cork City and Bowes, very close together in the table.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, both they're sixth and seventh, I think, at the table at the moment. So, you know, that's going to be a really tight game. You know, Bowes won well against, they were playing Pease, yeah, in the first round of the Cup. That was a really good win for them. And then Cork beat Douglas Hall 9-0 as well. So big results in their first round of the Cup. And yeah, again, it's going to be a tight game. It's hard to call that one.
And Treaty and Athlone Town down in Marketsfield as well. They'll be happy with that.
Yeah, exactly. I think Treaty kind of, I know they might look for a bit of a cup run just to invigorate this season a bit, because they've been sitting in the mid-table spot really all season. And then Athlone are really on form. Like, they beat Shells, like I said, in the league. So they're top of the league at the moment. And of course, they're the reigning cup champions too. So they might have their eye on the double as well this season. Who knows?
Who knows? Exactly. Big weekend to come. Maeve de Burke, thank you so much for that. Alan, where are you heading?
Talca Park tonight. Big game. Back to league action, Marie. And Shells going for the league. The heat is on Bowes as well, so a big game.
It really is. Okay, Alan, thank you so much for coming in. That is all we have time for. Andrew Dupre and the official chart show is up next. RTE 2FM.